Support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Tracy Ray from the employment law firm of Baron Liebman. Tracy says that OPB sponsorship is a great way to support the community and connect with Baron Liebman's clients.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, January 5th. We've made it. It's a new year, and it's an especially spicy one in terms of politics. There's a presidential election on the horizon, a coveted and presumably very safe Democratic congressional seat up for grabs, and Oregon's largest city is on the cusp of a total makeover and an unprecedented new form of government. And Oregon's legislature will meet for what's expected to be a consequential session next month. We'll do our best to set a lay of the land on all the issues and political jockeying to expect in 2024, before your mailboxes start overflowing with campaign flyers. Welcome to the podcast. I'm OPB Portland City Government reporter Alex Zielinski.
And I'm OPB Politics reporter Dirk Vanderhart.
Dirk, let's start with the legislature. Last year, lawmakers met for months on constitutionally mandated long session. The big topics were housing, homelessness, and jumpstarting Oregon's semiconductor industry. What's on the docket for the short session?
Yes, well, you know, legislative sessions, as a rule, take up a lot of topics. They feature hearings and votes on a huge variety of things. And even though lawmakers are only meeting for 35 days this year, this will be no different. But the word emerging from Salem right now is really that this session is going to be heavily, heavily oriented toward a couple things, toward taking steps to curb the addiction and overdose crises that the state's grappling with, and also doing more to address the housing shortage that has helped, you know, drive up housing costs and is a factor in rising homelessness here. Most lawmakers are also going to have their pet projects they're hoping to get by, their niche bills, all that good stuff. And we won't have a full picture of that until bills are finally made public on the legislature's website. But, you know, all the signals we are getting from leaders is that those two things, you know, drugs and housing, are the main events.
Right. There are a lot of people wondering exactly what we can expect from lawmakers when it comes to tweaking drug policy. What do we know?
So there are a lot of balls in the air on this right now, and then also a lot of questions about just how far lawmakers will actually go on this subject. You know, this is a legislature that, as we've talked about on this podcast before, in 2023 pretty much declined to make any major changes to Measure 110, which is the law that decriminalized possession of small amounts of drugs. That was, you know, despite calls by Republicans to repeal the measure. This year, though, the debate, I think, has shifted. Democrats that control both chambers appear all but certain to take at least some action tightening drug laws. It feels pretty certain to me right now, based on the conversations I'm having, that we'll see a law banning public drug use. That's something that is currently actually not illegal in the state due to a bit of a loophole in Measure 110, and something that the leaders of Portland and folks around the state are really calling for. I think we're also likely to see the legislature pass a bill that makes it easier to convict drug dealers. That's after a recent appeals court decision that prosecutors say threw up all sorts of hurdles. And we're also pretty certain to see some sort of effort to try to better connect people with addiction services. You know, as we're talking about harder hammers, I think lawmakers are really going to be focused on what we do to actually lift people up and get them the help that they need. What I think remains to be seen, though, is whether Democrats are pushed to go even further than maybe they would like to. There are a growing number of groups demanding that lawmakers recriminalize drug possession in the state. That includes leaders of cities like Portland. So this is not just Republicans arguing for recriminalization at this point. You know, there's a lot of pushback to that. People say recriminalizing is not going to help anything. In fact, it will hurt a lot of things. So this debate is going to be very lively and very interesting, and it will be a big deal in the session.
Got it. And another big deal is housing, which you mentioned, which is obviously something that's been a major concern for state policymakers and the public for a long time. What are we expecting on that front?
Several things. Governor Tina Kotek says she's going to focus on bolstering housing production during the session. You know, Kotek suffered a pretty remarkable defeat, I would say, at the end of last year's session on this subject. She had a proposal that would have weakened some of the state's land use rules to permit more housing to be built in some limited instances. That generated concerns from a lot of Democrats. It wound up narrowly failing in a pretty dramatic Senate vote on the last day of the 2023 session. So the governor has pledged to come back on that topic. And she's also done something that I think is sort of remarkable, which is to announce that she has plans to spend more than $600 million of the money lawmakers have available to them to spend this year on some of her housing initiatives, like building housing, acquiring housing, helping people pay rent, building new shelters. It's remarkable because it is pretty typical for governors to set out a proposed budget framework in odd years. That's the year that the legislature passes a new budget, so the governor sort of sets the tone. It's more rare and maybe unprecedented, according to some people I talk to, for a governor to do that ahead of a short session, which is really supposed to be about small budget tweaks and taking up really emergency measures. So it's going to be interesting to see if Kotek gets all that she wants.
Mm-hmm. So drug policy, housing policy, that's a lot to jam into just 35 days. What else are you expecting from this session?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is just sort of general budget stuff. There is going to be a decent amount of money we are hearing for the legislature to spend. They'll have to figure out how to choose among the many possible needs to spend that. But I think what's more notable is perhaps what we aren't expecting to hear. So Democrats this year appear to be really cautious about floating any sort of controversial proposal on topics that, you know, things like tighter gun laws, expanded abortion protections, mm-hmm. anything else that is likely to be very objectionable to Republicans. And that's because Democrats are really trying to avoid another walkout like we saw in 2023. Senate Republicans who launched that walkout last year have been clear that they aren't going to hesitate to leave again if they think it's necessary to block some bill they don't like. So I think Democrats are saying we have 35 days. We want to keep this low drama as much as possible, and we're going to keep some of that really live wire stuff off the table.
Yeah, so speaking of walkouts, we are anticipating a big ruling from the Oregon Supreme Court that concerns what happens when lawmakers boycott the session in these walkouts that happen year after year. What's happening there, and when might a ruling come down?
So the court is taking up a question about the exact meaning of Measure 113. That is the 2022 ballot measure that created new consequences for lawmakers who walk out to block bills from being passed. Our listeners probably remember, but the measure said any legislator with 10 or more unexcused absences could not seek re-election. So last year, as we've mentioned, 10 Republicans walked away. They walked out for 6 weeks, and so triggered those consequences. But now there's this interesting question about when the consequences actually kick in. When is a lawmaker actually blocked from seeking re-election? Pretty much every explanation of the measure that voters would have read ahead of the vote said that lawmakers would be blocked from seeking re-election in their next term, right? This would be a sort of immediate consequence. The problem is that the actual language the measure inserted into the state constitution didn't say that. In fact, if you read that language plainly, it seems to say that these senators could serve an entire extra 4-year term before being blocked from running. A bit of a drafting error, I think, on the people pushing this measure. So the question the court will answer soon is what this law actually means. That ruling could come as early as next week, and it'll have a major impact on the makeup of the Senate's GOP caucus moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's pivot to elections. Dirk, Oregonians will elect brand new people to 3 major roles in November. Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Treasurer are all up for grabs, and they all lack an incumbent seeking re-election. I know it's still a bit early, but what do these races look like right now?
Yeah, there's a lot here. Let's run it down, hopefully quickly. I'll start with what is probably the most interesting, which is the race to replace Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, who's retiring. Currently announced for that race are Dan Rayfield, the current House Speaker, a Corvallis Democrat. On the Republican side is Will Lathrop. He's an attorney, a former prosecutor, who has been raising money at a pretty good clip and looks to be mounting a serious campaign. And I think this is an interesting one because, you know, Democrats have run away with AG races recently. There has not been much competition, but Republicans think this year is a great chance to change that. They want this race to be all about crime, you know, disorder in Portland and other cities, overdoses, all the sort of really bad things that we're experiencing right now, they plan to hammer Democrats for that state of affairs. For Secretary of State, we have a contested race between a couple Democrats. State Treasurer Tobias Reed, who's term limited in his current role, is hoping to make the switch to Secretary. He's running against State Senator James Manning of Eugene. On the Republican side, there are a couple people filed, but no one who is raising money or considered particularly viable or serious in Republican circles. You know, that's kind of interesting because Secretary is the last statewide office Republicans won in Oregon when Dennis Richardson won in 2016. But as of now, the party seems to be steering clear. Lastly, there is the race to replace Tobias Reed as state treasurer. Right now, this is another race where only Democrats have filed. State Senator Elizabeth Steiner, who is one of the legislature's budget chairs, looks like an early favorite. She's a Democrat. She's up against Jeff Goodman, who's running a Democrat for the first time, but has actually run for treasurer twice before as the Republican nominee. So that, you know, you got to figure the longtime Democrat has an edge, but we shall see.
And we know Oregonians love their ballot measures. What are any ballot measures that you anticipate gaining enough momentum to land on ballots this November? Is there anything in the works?
Yeah, plenty in the works. You know, it is always hard to say at this point. We have around 6 months until signatures are due to qualify. And there are a ton. I mean, there's like 54 or something measures that are at least theoretically working toward making the ballot. That includes a lot of different things. Proposals to ease gun control laws, to ensure any new highway tolls are approved by voters, or even repeal that new law that allows Oregonians to pump their own gas. But I think the most interesting questions are in the areas of campaign finance and in drug laws. Right now, there are actually competing ballot measure proposals for creating campaign finance limits in Oregon. Remember, folks, we have none. One is being put forward by good government groups. There's an alternative being put forward by public sector unions and their allies. And it's possible we could see a situation. These groups disagree on some pretty fundamental things of how this should look. And it's possible we could see a situation where Oregonians have two dueling measures on the ballot on campaign finance, which I assume would get very confusing very quickly. The other thing I think we're watching are proposals that would ask voters to recriminalize drug possession, as we were talking about earlier, and also do some other things to crack down on drugs in the state. There are some pretty deep pocketed backers behind that push, folks that in theory have the money to get something on the ballot. But I think it remains to be seen whether this is an actual campaign or just sort of an empty threat designed to force lawmakers to take action.
Mm-hmm. So importantly, Oregon is also going to have one of the most closely watched congressional races in the country. All eyes seem to be on the 5th congressional district. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, this is one of those sort of often dissected districts that, you know, elected a Republican to Congress, even though it supported Joe Biden in 2020. It's a district that has really a razor-thin margin, and so is one of the few true swing districts in the country. It's currently represented by Congresswoman Lori Chavez Dreamer. She's a Republican, and she's really spent the last year in office walking a bit of a tightrope. At times, she has bucked some of the more conservative leanings of her party. Like she opposed Jim Jordan as speaker when he ran, but then she wound up backing current speaker Mike Johnson, who's seen as sort of just as conservative as Jordan, but maybe a bit more soft-spoken or pleasant. Mm-hmm. So she'll be working to sort of do that, to show the 5th district that she's in balance with its residents. And right now, I think the big question is who she's going to face off against. There is a 3-way Democratic primary that features Jamie McLeod Skinner of Terrebonne. She's the candidate who lost to Chavez Dreamer by about 2 percentage points in 2022. She's going up against State Representative Janelle Bynum of Clackamas, who's actually defeated Chavez Dreamer in a pair of elections for the State House. And also running is Metro Council President Lynn Peterson. A lot of interest in which of those women ultimately gets the Democratic nomination. There's a bunch of other congressional races. Obviously, all of our 6 congressional seats are up for grabs. Mm-hmm. The 4th and 6th are held by Democrats who could face a bit of a tough election, depending on sort of the dynamics of those races. But it does look like they are in more control for Democrats. Mm-hmm. But there is a major question about which Democrat will win the primary to replace longtime Congressman Earl Blumenauer, who is also retiring. We currently have 3 central contenders for that, Multnomah County Commissioner Sushila Jayapal, Gresham City Councilor Eddie Morales, and State Representative Maxine Dexter. This is a safe bet, as you alluded to earlier, Alex, that whoever prevails in that primary is going to be the next member of Congress. So this is going to be a very closely watched primary. And that is a lot from me on state and national stuff. But Alex, we should zoom way in and take a look at Portland. This is going to be a year of extremely big change in the city's government. And the November election is going to set the course for that overhaul. Can you remind us what these big changes look like?
Yeah, I will try. So 2 years ago, Portlanders approved a ballot measure that triples the size of its city council from 4 to 12. The voter-approved plan also divides the city into 4 geographic voting districts, where 3 council members will represent each district. And under this new system, city council members will no longer oversee bureaus like water, parks, fire. That role will be held by a brand new city administrator appointed by the mayor. And instead, councilors will largely focus on making policies that reflect their district's needs, which is really different than what we've seen in the past almost 100 years of government in Portland. In that same ballot measure, voters got rid of primary elections, so that means Portlanders will elect that brand new 12-person city council in a November election, and there won't be a May election to narrow down that pool of candidates. All current commissioners, their terms will end in December 2024. The plan is for this new government to just really jumpstart January 1st, 2025. That ballot measure also directed the city to adopt a new voting system called ranked choice voting, which will also be used in this year's election.
A lot there. we have, you know, for one, 7 more people on the city council than before. Mm-hmm. There are already a ton of people vying for a role on this new council, right? I keep hearing new names.
Yeah, there's nearly 40 people who have already announced plans to run, and dozens more suspected of joining the race. I feel like every day I hear from someone who knows someone who is planning to join the race. It really seems to be like the race to join this year for a few reasons. One, it pays pretty well. The new structure gives city council members a $6,000 pay raise to their annual salary, which will be about $133,000. And there are just better chances of actually winning, since candidates just need to get enough votes from people in their own district instead of a citywide campaign. And I also think a lot of people are just interested in the experiment that is this new, completely different style of government and just figuring out what that looks like and kind of where power is held. There is also a problem with having so many candidates. That's because a lot of these people have signed up to participate in the city's campaign financing program, which rewards candidates who pledge to only accept individual campaign donations under $350. The reward is basically the city matches those candidates. The first $20 of all individual donations are matched to 9-1, which effectively turns a $20 donation into $180. But since so many people have signed up for this program, it looks like the city is going to go broke and run out of money to support candidates, to meet this need, which means some candidates who are expecting more public funding may have a lot less to rely on. So that's kind of a wrench that's been thrown into this process, at least so far.
I want to ask about one of the points you made, which is that, you know, in Portland, it's been pretty hard, actually, to win a city council race. We are used to these massive, expensive, citywide campaigns that people need to launch. How do you think council campaigns are going to look different, if at all, under this new structure where people aren't running for the entire city, they're just running for their specific district to elect them?
Yeah, you know, I've heard from candidates that they really expect the campaigns to be a bit more localized, kind of grassroots, with more neighborhood events and door knocking, because, you know, candidates have a smaller geographic area to focus on, a little bit more narrowed down. You know, hypothetically, like you said, this could be less costly for candidates. But it also looks like there will still be a lot of money being poured into these campaigns. It's really hard to know what to expect at this point, to be honest. It'll be really interesting to watch it all unfold in the months to come.
And it's kind of interesting that we expect city council to be this focal point, which makes sense because we are also voting for a mayor next year, which is always sort of the big focal point in a city election year like this, and also an auditor. What can you tell me about those more executive races?
Yeah, so you might remember that Mayor Ted Wheeler is hanging up his hat. He's not running for a third term. His colleagues on council, however, are almost all interested in his seat. Commissioners Renee Gonzalez and Mingus Maps have announced their mayoral runs, and it's all but certain that Commissioner Carmen Rubio is also joining that race. So that'll really turn the next 10 months of council discussions into stump speeches, basically, you know, as a platform for commissioners to try out for mayor. And then the current auditor, Simone Reddy, is running for re-election. There's no one who has announced plans to challenge her yet. It seems like people are largely happy with her. So, you know, we'll see there.
You said up top that, you know, part of these changes is a new type of voting that Portland voters are going to experience for the first time. It is complicated. Can you just explain how it works or try to explain how it works? And what is the upshot? What is the benefit potentially of this kind of voting?
So yeah, it's called ranked choice voting. And like you said, it's perhaps the most complex piece to the entire voter-approved changes to city government that has been introduced. Let me try to break it down. So first, right now, if a Portland City Council candidate collects more than 50% of votes in a primary election, they automatically win. If no candidate receives a majority in the primary, the top two candidates move on to the general election in November. But like I said earlier, the new voting system does away with the primary elections for city offices, which instead of condensing this process down into one election cycle in November. And with ranked choice voting for the four new districts, each Portland voter will elect three commissioners to represent them by ranking up to six candidates on their ballots by preference. Basically, you know, the first in line is the person they really want to win. Last is the person they're really uninterested in representing them. Then after ballots are cast, the counting begins. Any candidate who gets over 25% of the first choice votes on those ballots automatically wins that council seat. But if no candidate gets the majority of the vote, the candidate with the least amount of votes is eliminated, the second choice votes for that candidate are redistributed, and the process continues until a candidate wins more than 25% of the vote. It kind of cycles around, shedding off folks who have collected the least amount of votes just by preference. So it's quite different than what we currently have. And the main goal is to better reflect voters' preferences. You know, like if their top pick doesn't win, maybe their second choice does, and it won't be as terrible for them as they, you know, might anticipate. It's a voting style that's become increasingly common across the U.S., and I believe Oregon is even considering adopting it or having a ballot measure kind of related to that next or this year. So it's not unusual, even though it's deeply challenging to explain.
Yeah, and you were reminding me that I was remiss earlier on ballot measures. The legislature has put forward a number of things that voters are absolutely going to consider, and one of those is whether we should use ranked choice voting for a number of our elections. It is a different style of voting than what Portland is doing, though. And you know, I'll say that to the extent that I've talked to people about the Portland system, I have heard worries that it is so confusing and just so different maybe from what people are used to that at least initially, you know, could it cut into people's trust of the system? Could it be so difficult to explain what actually happened?
And to explain the difference too, just to make sure, like the difference is that we're electing three people on one ballot versus one person per ballot, because we're electing, you know, three people to represent us in our districts. And so that's how it's kind of different than the normal, you know, voting for one person for an office. And it's super tricky to kind of unpack and explain. I think at the same time, it's sometimes hard to just explain and understand how the current voting system works. If you'd ask an average Portlander, how does your, you know, vote get counted, it wouldn't be entirely easy to explain. But you're right, it's a bit mind-boggling to try to suss out.
So you have laid out more than enough for us to consider about local elections in Portland, but probably there's more. I assume there's other things people are going to have to consider this year. Any big issues you want to flag?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the issues are pretty similar to what you mentioned about what's being discussed at the state level. You know, everyone locally is watching for a new plan proposed by the city and county to improve the regional homelessness response system to see if that actually meets its goals. We're also going to see the city open more large-scale outdoor shelters, and we're maybe going to see the result of a lawsuit against the city law, which banned daytime camping. Depending on how that goes, we could see that law actually being enforced this year. And if the state legislature follows through, like you mentioned, the city may be also begin enforcing a law against public drug use. We're also going to see a new drug treatment center open in Southeast Portland. And there are rumblings about finally reopening a 24/7 sobering center for people needing to detox in the city. And we'll also see the council, city council, contemplate ways to make housing construction cheaper in an attempt to spur development. There's also a lot of discussion around policing, especially in terms of kind of the future of the city's settlement agreement with the Department of Justice over how Portland police use force against folks with mental illnesses. You know, we're a decade into that settlement, and I think everyone involved is hoping to move past that this year. All of this work is going to be complicated by the city having major budget gaps that could lead to layoffs and program closures. So there's a lot on the horizon, and the fact that most city commissioners are running for office will surely add to the political drama of it all. So let's leave the conversation here for now. This is obviously just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to continue to dig into these big political stories on the podcast this year. Dirk, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Alex.
This week's episode was produced by Andrew Thien, and our audio engineer is Nalene Silva. Our music comes from Audio Network. We'll be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Until then, you can find all of OPB's reporting at opb.org. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
If you tune into OPB Politics Now because you love learning about what's happening in our region, you'll love listening to The Evergreen. This weekly podcast paints an audio portrait of the Pacific Northwest through the stories of the people who live here. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.